Saturday and afternoon night, folks. I am Jake Mosier, and this is the Super Mosier Brothers Show, a podcast where two brothers and best friends take their lifelong passion of talking about video games away from the family dinner table and to the microphone. I am alone today. Sam is on a plethora of travels, one in California, and then one, I think, in New York. He is going coast to coast to do video game-related work activities. I'm sure he will have some stories when he gets back. But that won't even be by next week. That will actually be the week after that. So either fortunately or unfortunately, depending on how much you enjoy these solo episodes, you will have just me for 2 weeks in a row. What does that look like for your ears? Or what does that sound like for your ears? For this week, it will be a short news recap, some things that happened this past week that I want to talk about. It won't be a very long episode. I don't feel great. I have a minor headache. I did get the flu and COVID shot earlier today, and I wonder if that is getting to me, or maybe I'm just tired. I did stay up too late playing Balatro on mobile, so that could also be the cause. But alas, that is what this week will be about. And then next week, if I can beat it in time, which I think, in fact, I can, you will be getting a review of the single-player campaign in Suicide Squad Kill the Justice League. I have a lot of thoughts. I've been keeping notes, and I'm excited to share that with you all. So if you have any questions about Suicide Squad Kill the Justice League, feel free to reach out. I will do my best to answer them, best to share my opinion on them. Outside of that, how are you doing? How are you feeling? How is life going? Are you traveling a lot for work? Have you been able to stay put? Not that anyone is actually going to reach out and let me know. Our family, and it seems that most of my friends, their falls are very busy, significantly busier than their springs and minorly more busy than their summers. I know that's the case for our family, from birthdays to the evident holidays that happen in the late fall, early winter. Along with just a plethora of other things that always seem to land between the mid-September to December mark. I love it. It's super exciting, but things are busy. So is your fall busy? Do you have a lot of shit going on? I don't know. In terms of other things to just rant about at the beginning, airplanes. So prior to Sam's travel, I did a lot of travel for work. I went to Nashville for a little over 24 hours. I had 24 hours in Kansas City, and then I was in Fort Worth, Texas, and then I went to Minneapolis for the Hans Zimmer concert, which was absolutely fantastic. Go check my Twitter for a quick clip of the Pirates of the Caribbean soundtrack. But all of that aside, I spent a lot of time on airplanes that week. And I think to much people's surprise, prior to my current job, I didn't fly a lot. With a family of five, it's expensive to fly, so we mostly drove if we were going on vacation. And because of that, until recently, I wasn't very familiar with the whole airplane process. Every time I went, I had to look up what I can bring, what I can't bring, what all the rules were. I would get there way, way too early, and I'm still doing that. And I think I've officially decided that the whole be there 2 hours early thing is insane. I think it, at most, try to be there an hour early, unless you're going at like the busiest travel time of the year, presumably holidays. But I don't understand how they aren't more efficient. It doesn't make sense to me. I was talking to my girlfriend. They should, I hate to say it, because they control enough, they affect enough things. We need to get the mouse in here. Uh-huh. You guys are all saying, uh-huh. Oh, that was really bad. But alas, they need to get Disney in here, because the one thing I commend Disney World on every time I go is the efficiency in which they push people through those lines. Don't get me wrong. There are still like 2 hour waits on occasion, not very often, but they do happen. But most of the lines move quite quickly unless the ride goes down, and that's because they are very efficient about who gets on the ride, how many people get on a ride, what groups they push first, what groups they save for later, et cetera, et cetera. That's not being very specific, but if you've been there, you get what I mean. And I don't understand how fucking airplanes and airlines have not figured this shit out. I flew Southwest for the first half of the week, and then I flew Delta and American. Three different ones. All not great. Southwest, even though they're getting rid of it next year, they currently have the preschool elementary school system. Hey, line up. Not single file. They would rather you line up in a huddle to then have four people ask you what your number is, because those people are very passionate about making sure they get on the plane a whole 15 seconds earlier than prior. That system's not great, though I will say I think it did move faster than American and Delta. But then you have the other system where They're calling it by these group numbers, which seems to take forever. And then you have people on the plane who, for some reason, always struggle to put their bag in the upper portion. If you're short, if you have a disability, that's perfectly fine. There are like people who just stand there in the aisle staring at all the options for where they can shove their bag. There was a man whose wife was putting her bag up there. It took her 55 seconds after the bag was in the cargo hold thing, whatever, the upper bins, to then sit down. And instead of just like shuffling to the side so people could get through, he placed both his arms on one chair on the left aisle, one chair on the right aisle, and just refused to let people through so his wife could very slowly sit down. Not that it really matters, because the plane is going to leave at the same time it was planning to leave, whether that man was doing what he was doing. But I was just amazed at the inefficiency of airplanes for something that's been around for so long that we haven't figured that out yet, that we haven't made it a smoother, nicer experience. And I guess the answer to that question is we have. Those people just pay for the smoother experience. And I guess I'm never going to win that battle. Second conversation topic. I went to an Italian restaurant earlier this week in Kansas City. It is called Cupini's, C-U-P-I-N-I apostrophe S. If you live in KC, I guess it's worth a try. It is a lovely patio. But there are two things that made me laugh. Well, one thing that made me laugh, one thing that I would like to pose to you all. First thing, they had in the outdoor patio a lovely, a very expensive, probably 75-inch OLED Samsung TV. What was on that TV? A YouTube video that I can only guess was named 3-hour POV first person walk through Italy. They were just walking through the streets. It looked like I was in a Costco, specifically one that was really focused on marketing the travel industry of Italy. It was very, very funny. That's what played the entire time I was there. And I do wonder if they bought the TV just for that. Seems like an interesting choice. Second, meatball sandwiches. I don't know if anyone who listens to this is a fan of meatball sandwiches, but what the fuck is the point of meatball sandwiches? They're yummy, don't get me wrong. But they are, I would argue, 95% of the time, uneatable in the current version of what's handed to you. You get handed the sandwich with the 2 to 3 massive meatballs that you definitely cannot fit them in your mouth. And if you can, they are going to fall out, shoot out of the bread, fall on your lap, fall on the plate, fall on the person next to you, maybe fall on the old lady walking by you. It's a mess. I had to take them out to cut them in half just to make the sandwich edible. All right, edible is not the right word, but more easily consumable. It was a delicious sandwich. I had a great time at Cupini's, but we need to figure out meatball sandwiches. I think we should just automatically cut them in half. It's going to come in sandwich form. Don't make me do that. Or maybe just make the meatballs smaller. Not entirely sure what the fix is there. But alas, enough about airplanes and Italian restaurants with big OLED TVs. I'm here to talk to you about some news. It's a solo episode, which means I'm going to be just tackling a few things I thought were interesting in this past week. That includes the September 2024 PlayStation State of Play and the Assassin's Creed Shadows delay. Thank you to anyone who's listening. It means so much. If you enjoy our show, please subscribe to it in your podcast. Please leave us a review, share with your friends. It would mean the galaxy to us. Really would appreciate any engagement if you do listen to the show. Even if it's just, hey, I like this, I don't like this, I appreciate any and all feedback. Moving on to the topic of the show, which is just the news. Let's start with the PlayStation State of Play. What are my overall thoughts? It was pretty good. State of Plays are weird. We've talked about them extensively on the show, and I will get into my thoughts on PlayStation's current quote-unquote marketing brand in a little bit. But to just focus on this State of Play, I thought it was solid. I would argue is one of the best State of Plays we have ever gotten. That is for a few reasons. One, I think, which is going to be slightly contrary to what I'm about to say in a few minutes, but I think I've started to wrap my head around about what they want to do with State of Plays, and I think this went slightly above my expectations, which is always a good place to be. I think the fill-in games, which is what I would essentially call everything after the first game and before the last game, all the third-party partnerships that they made, all the companies that they signed with to have a game here, all those marketing deals, those games looked pretty cool, and many of them appealed to me. There were a few cool surprises. And then I thought it was paced pretty well. They had a few more very, very short periods of talking heads, which I think is a nice break from the robotic AI voice. I think they had a good combination of first-party stuff, third-party stuff, console-related things like the PS5 Pro, like new controllers and console plates. I think that the combination of what they had here was neat. It was justified. I enjoyed it. To talk about what the fuck is going on with the marketing brand of PlayStation right now, I'll get into the games after this, because obviously that's more fun. We've talked about this on the show a lot. PlayStation, however many years ago, started State of Play. Many people assumed it was going to be the quote-unquote rival to a Nintendo Direct, their version of we're done with E3, these are our showcases to, bad word to use, these are our videos, our marketing materials to show our games off whenever we feel ready. And that was the case for probably a year, maybe a little longer. I honestly don't remember the timeline, but that was the case for a little bit. And it was pretty good. They were not phenomenal. They were, I don't think, ever Nintendo Direct levels of excitement, but they were decent. There were some pretty big announcements at those first ones. But then shortly after, into COVID with the PS5, they started having these showcases, these PlayStation showcases, which were more focused on first party and had a lot larger announcements, a lot more exciting games shown. And that became the new expectation for probably the last 2.5, 3 years. I guess the PlayStation 5 was 2020, the last 4 years. And funny enough, we've only gotten 4 or 5, but when a PlayStation showcase was announced, it was time to get excited. And inversely, when State of Plays were announced, very quickly after that branding started, it was pretty well known that you shouldn't get too excited for a State of Play. There might be a few cool games shown, a few dates solidified, but it's nothing to compare to a Nintendo Direct. Well, as of late, after last year's very disappointing PlayStation Showcase, after a lack of one this year, and a refocus on State of Plays, one that earlier this year featured the announcement of Astro Bot, we got another one that featured the announcement of the pseudo-sequel to Ghost of Tsushima called Ghost of, I don't know if it's Yotei or Yotai, I apologize that I'm probably going to mispronounce it for the rest of the show. It, once again, put a massive question mark on what the fuck a piece of PlayStation marketing means. I know this sounds so silly to talk about, but as someone who works in marketing, I find it interesting and is, I think, in an industry where it's so important and it's so vital to how your game performs and how it's perceived, as we talked about in the Concord episode, I do find it very interesting. And you could very much have sold the last State of Play, the one with Astrobot, as a one-off, as a random exception to the rule that due to timing, due to the current place of many of their games along the development pipeline, they just didn't have enough ready, so it was a more exciting than usual State of Play. That's fine. But we now have two in a row where you had Astrobot, and that was in the summer, had Astrobot announced, and now we have a Ghost game announced with a few other things in there. We to go to Polygon, shout out Michael McWhorter. So the Ghost sequel was announced. Some Astrobot DLC was talked about. Horizon Zero Dawn remastered, I don't really care or have too much to say about. But LEGO Horizons Adventures got a date. Monster Hunter Wilds got a date. Dynasty Warriors Origins got a date. There was a cool VR game called The Midnight Walk announced. Hell is Us, a very cool dark action adventure game, was shown. Power World is coming to PS5. If you take that with a few of the things that were shown at the last State of Play and you say, hey, we're going to have a shorter showcase, it's going to be 25 minutes and you have some of this stuff, maybe not 25 minutes, 40 minutes, that could have been really, really cool and I think pretty successful. You throw in a teaser to one of the big PlayStation games, or maybe we actually show what Fair Games is so that we start to give people an accurate perception of the game and not repeat the Concord situation. I find it very confusing that they are doing it the way they are doing it. It almost felt like Astrobot, obviously because it was coming out this year, they needed to talk about it. It was a necessity, they didn't have a choice. And it feels like Ghost was put here, not only because it's coming out next year, you get people excited, no big deal, but because after everything that's happened with PlayStation over the last month, they needed a bit of positive PR. I don't think that's why that's here, but I do think it's an added benefit. But I do think that they are creating due to how the games industry works with these showcases, they are creating either unrealistic expectations for a state of play or unrealistic expectations for the showcases, just in terms of how people perceive that they the frequency that they should be happening at. And obviously, it'd be very weird for them to have to come out and be, not make a statement, that sounds dramatic, but come out and be like, hey, the PlayStation showcases are no longer happening. We are only doing PlayStation State of Play from here on out. Some will be bigger than others. Some will be less important. Nintendo defined their brand so well over the course of the past few years. You just know for each type of showcase what your expectations should be. They do a very good job of setting expectations. PlayStation has done a decent job of setting those before these showcases with their communication, whether it be tweets or a blog post. But I still think there is a weird question mark to every single one of their quote-unquote showcases marketing videos. I would have said there is a less than 5% chance that the Ghost sequel is here. But it was, and it was cool, and because I'm a hardcore fan, I watched this, but, and I don't have the numbers, I would have to go back and look, and I would recommend you do this, at what the showcase YouTube numbers look like compared to a State of Play YouTube numbers, but I would imagine the showcases have more views. I find it very weird that they are shoving a game like Ghost of Yote here and not saving it for something like a showcase. But that makes me to believe that this game is coming out earlier next year, at least first half of next year, and they don't have time to wait for something like that. They don't have games ready to fill a showcase like that. I think their mistake in the first place was ever doing these showcases. I understood it for the announcement of the PS5. They should have labeled those PlayStation 5 specific events just for the launch and never done it again, and just made State of Play their thing. On occasion, they're better than other times, or maybe they have a big summer one, kind of like Nintendo does. You know the summer one is going to be more important than the other ones. I don't know. I think they need to commit to one thing, whether it be the State of Play branding, the PlayStation Showcase branding. They need to start to decide where things are going to be, because it won't matter for Ghost of Yote, most likely, but I think a game like Concord was affected by the confusion of these two types of marketing. That's why I think this is important. The last showcase was so hyped up because they'd been silent for 2 years. It came and it was a massive disappointment. Concord was part of that massive disappointment. The next place they talked about it was at a State of Play with an awful trailer. So they put it in the lesser type of showcase, at least in the perception of the people who dominate the conversation online. And along with putting it in what people would deem a lesser place, they showed a disappointing trailer. I think it's important for their games, more important for their new IPs, for their multiplayer projects, to put them in a defined space, one that people are excited about and know what it's going to be. That's why I think it's important to define it. I think it makes people's expectations more level set, and I think it puts their games in a better place from the jump. That's enough about the marketing side of the State of Play. Let's get into the games. You're going to hear me through a lot of this episode use two phrases, and it's how I'm going to frame, maybe Sam and I will start using it, but I'm definitely going to use it on my solo episodes. Points of positivity and notes of negativity. Let's start with some points of positivity with Ghost of Yote. Like I said, a massive surprise. I did not expect to see this. I'm a massive fan of Ghost of Tsushima. I think it does what many PlayStation open world games do better than other developers' open world games, which is a focus on combat. Combat feels really, really good in Ghost of Tsushima, and I'm excited to see that evolve in Ghost of Yote. But my two points of positivity I really want to focus on, besides that this trailer is fucking gorgeous, go watch it. They're continuing the amazing vistas of the last game. What I want to focus on is one, a new protagonist. And this kind of ties into my second point of positivity. So let's just use the blanket one, which is the choice to provide a sense of newness to a quote-unquote sequel, a pseudo-sequel. One big complaint I've had with PlayStation over the past few years, and this is just a complaint of the larger entertainment industry, is the focus on sequels, known IP, iterating on the same thing. It makes more sense in games than in other industries where, for the sake of, let's use Ghost of Tsushima, which technically they're not even doing this, but I'm sure they are for certain animations and certain menus and fonts, etc. But video games are so expensive, you spend all these years building out these assets, and they're thrown away after one game if you don't make a sequel. Shout out to the Yakuza games for constantly reusing assets. That's why they can get a game out almost every year. And so I want to commend this team for really attempting to do something new within the same circle. I was, of course, going to play a Ghost of Tsushima 2, but I would have been slightly disappointed for a few reasons. One, I just like new things. I like getting new experiences and not just getting 30 more hours of what is a very similar product. For example, I love Spider-Man 2, but that is a very similar product to Spider-Man 1 in terms of how it feels on a moment-to-moment basis. They took a lot of risk here. One, they kind of already talked about this, but we're not returning to the Island of Tsushima, which I think is awesome. I don't have to revisit the same area, which, I mean, isn't always a complaint. I love Tears of the Kingdom, but they did a lot to freshen that up, and I don't really see how they could do that with the Island of Tsushima, but I love that they're visiting a new area. I think that is fantastic. I think the better choice is that they have a new protagonist. I think Jin Sakai was fine. I don't think he was anything special, and I think in order to make the quote-unquote ghost of blank brand persist for longer to stay more relevant for a longer period of time, do not stick with one quote-unquote ghost. I think, I hate to say it because many people said it was copying this from the start, I think taking the Assassin's Creed model for ghosts is a fantastic idea, because now, if Ghost of Yote sells incredibly well, they obviously could make a Ghost of blank and do a third ghost game. But if they don't want to, they can make a new IP, they could do another Infamous, they could completely switch genres and do a first-person game, but they could return back to the Ghost franchise with basically no strings attached. They don't have to return to the story of Jin Sakai or, I don't know the main character, Ghost of Yote, the new hero is called Atsu. They could return to Atsu's story or Jin Sakai's story or neither and do a third new character. It allows the franchise to be more than what it is. Like, Horizon Zero Dawn, I think is struggling with that right now, and they are attempting to expand it beyond what it is, talking about the online co-op game that is eventually going to come out. I'm sure you are not going to play as Aloy and friends in that game, but their next game, they gotta make a Horizon 3 because they have to finish out the trilogy, and that is something that Ghost is just not going to be burdened by now, which I think is a great call. I am excited for a new protagonist. I think, fuck all the dumb people online, it's a woman, I don't want to play. I mean, I'm doing it right now, so I shouldn't say what I'm about to say, but I think we should just stop talking about those people. They're a minority online who don't actually have any impact on this. I think this game will sell incredibly well. I think it will be fantastic, and I can't wait. So go watch that Ghost of Yote trailer if you've not, and shout out to Sucker Punch for trying something new. Excited to see what the guns look like, the new weapons look like. Can't wait. Notes of negativity. Speaking of Horizon, Horizon Zero Dawn Remastered. This is fine. In my head, when this was rumored / leaked, I assumed it was a way for those who weren't in a place in the current development pipeline to start on their section of work, that this gave them something to do. This gave them work to do on the side, to fill the day, whatever. I don't think I'm fully right about that. I also don't really know how game development works, so maybe that's never how it happens. But Nixxis is working on this. They acquired Nixxis 4 or 5 years back to do ports to PC, which they have done, and most of them have been pretty good. I think the only one that was really bad was the Last of Us Part 1 port. But where my note of negativity is coming from is that if Nixxis is going to do something like this is not porting to PC, this is remastering a game that is on the PS4 and currently playable on PS5 to just make it look slightly better. I wish they would have spent that time, because don't get me wrong, it does look better. It's comparable to Horizon Forbidden West. The facial animation looks a lot better, but I wish they would have spent that time that they spent making Horizon Zero Dawn Remastered, remaking or remastering a different game, one from PS3, PS2, PS1, one that actually needs it. I am sure Nixxis has the capability to become what Bluepoint is now, to start taking the older PlayStation library and making that more accessible now. I understand that some of those games might not sell as well, but it is, and maybe it's more work, but I would love to see the financial breakdown on what it costs to remaster Horizon Zero Dawn. They talked about in the video that they re-recorded however many like voice capture scenes and lines, which is crazy, because that is very expensive. To my knowledge, that's one of the more expensive components of game development. what does that breakdown look like with how much that costs and how much it will sell versus, hey, we remade the Sly Cooper trilogy. That is coming out next year. How much does that sell? I'm very curious what the dynamic is there and what that could have looked like. That's my note of negativity. I knew this was coming. It's fine. It looks better. If you've never played it and you own a PS5, awesome. You get to play it now at a higher fidelity. Very happy for you, but I think that time and resources could have been used elsewhere. The last PlayStation thing I want to talk about, another note of negativity, is the PlayStation Chroma Collection. They announced three new controllers and three new console plates. The three colors they announced are Chroma Pearl, which is a off-white that moves through a range of cheek pinks and creams. This is coming from the PlayStation blog. Chroma Indigo, which shifts between deep blues and vivid purples, and Chroma Teal, which shimmers through several fresh shades of green. I think these are pretty ugly outside of the Chroma Pearl. I think the Chroma Pearl is a fun version of the current PlayStation we have. Gives it a little more specifically for the console. I think the controller itself looks fine. But the Chroma Indigo, personally, I'm not a big fan of purple or blue with black. I think they're just both darker colors that I personally don't find appealing. And when you combine the blue and the purple with the black, I just think it's kind of ugly. The green one is fine. I don't love it. I don't hate it. Again, I don't think the darker green, teal green, whatever you want to call it, looks great with the black. And the main note of negativity I want to get across here is, why is PlayStation so bad at designing controllers and console variations? I say this caveating that the Astrobot controller is beautiful. And I think the Concord controller was decent. I bought the Astrobot controller. It looks awesome. And the PlayStation Anniversary products also look incredible. I wish those were available much more widely than they are. I'm sure I could get a controller if I tried, but I just spent money on a controller. I don't need another one. But all of their non-limited edition, more expensive versions are not great. The first slate of PlayStation controllers, the red, the purple, I don't think are great. I think they introduced the dual tone this generation, which I was excited about, and they haven't done much with it. They've basically only had the second tone be white or black. I think there's an opportunity to do maybe what Xbox is doing. I think Xbox, if we want to give Xbox kudos to in any area of video games, it's their controller design. There was a see-through white and gold controller this week that I fucking adore and was tempted to buy. I just don't play my Xbox enough. I just would love to see PlayStation kind of look outside the box and do some cool color combos or something like a see-through translucent shell as opposed to what we're getting with many of their controller collections. But that aside, let's go to a point of positivity. I want to shout out my favorite third-party show in here. That is a game called Hell Is Us. Let me go to the PlayStation blog. I would recommend you go watch the video. It's on YouTube. If you just search Hell Is Us gameplay, I'm sure you can see it. This game is out 2025. This comes from their executive creator, director, Jonathan Jacques Belletete. He comes from a studio called Rogue Factor. Hello, everyone. I'm Jonathan, creative director and art director at Rogue Factor, and today I'm excited to take you behind the scenes of our latest project, Hell Is Us. The game represents a bold evolution in how we design our gaming experiences, and I'm thrilled to share with you the elements that make HIU a truly unique adventure. We revealed the first gameplay footage of our game in today's state of play, and we're thrilled to hear your thoughts on it. We hope you enjoyed this sneak peek. This marks the beginning of our communication journey about Hell Is Us, and we can't wait to share more with you. Today, I'd like to tell you about a core concept of our game, which is very close to my heart, that truly defines the Hell Is Us experience and identity. If you haven't heard about this game before, though, it's a third-person action-adventure game set in a complex world that will challenge your intellect while, we hope, delivering a compelling and mature story. Hell Is Us was designed to break away from conventional norms to offer something radically different. Unlike many modern games that guide players with detailed maps, quest markers, quest journals, and constant assistance, we've chosen to eliminate those traditional aids altogether. In Hell Is Us, you won't have a magical map or compass revealing all points of interest, no markers identifying your next quest objective, and no artificial or mechanical guides to orient you. Today, we invite you to dive directly into the game's universe and rely on your own observation, reasoning, and intuition to progress. The environments are not there simply to decorate, they are there to communicate. I love Breath of the Wild. I love Tears of the Kingdom. And not enough games have actually taken what makes those games great and evolved them. Frankly, I'd be fine if you just stole them. Many of them have, they say they try Ghost of Tsushima, Gods and Monsters, whatever the new version of that was actually called, the Ubisoft game. Not many have actually executed on it. They talk about it. I would say Elden Ring got the closest to it. And I love to see a developer tackling this and really emphasizing how important it is to the core design of their game. I think the trailer looks awesome. I love the aesthetics. It reminds me of, it's like Death Stranding meets old World War mixed with alien energy. I'm really into it. I think the combat looks fun. It looks like a high octane action game, more like a Stellar Blade than a Souls-like. And that makes me exciting. I don't know if this game will be good. I don't think they've really worked on a ton before, but they're starting from a good place, a great first showing. That's enough about the PlayStation Showcase. Let me know what you thought. Reach out to our Twitter account. I would happily talk about your thoughts on the show next week. But next, the Assassin's Creed Shadows delay. Let's jump to the article. If you are unaware, I will give you all the details. This comes from Rock Paper Shotgun, written by Edwin Evans Thirlwell. Assassin's Creed Shadows delayed to 2025 as Ubisoft try to recover from, quote, softer than expected Star Wars Outlaws launch. This, I'll give you a heads up that this article definitely has some fun, so pardon the weird choice of lingo, but I appreciated it. The Ass Creed faithful have waited 1,000 years for a sequel set in feudal Japan, birthplace of ninjas and samurai. Woe unto ye dreamers of Ubisoft takes on Tenchu, for you must carry that candle for a little longer. Assassin's Creed Shadows has been delayed till next year. It was due on November 12th, 2024, now it will release on February 14th, 2025. The news comes in the shape of an updating of Ubisoft's targets for the financial year 2024 to 2025, primarily in response to the, quote, softer-than-expected launch for Star Wars Outlaws, end quote. According to Uncle Ubi, Assassin's Creed Shadows is feature-complete, but needs more time in the oven to avoid a similar dismal showing. Quote, while the game is feature-complete, the learnings from the Star Wars Outlaws release led us to provide additional time to further polish the title. This will enable the biggest entry in the franchise to fully deliver on its ambition, notably by fulfilling the promise of our dual protagonist adventure with Nao and Yosuke bringing two very different gameplay styles. There's a lot more there if you'd like to go read about Ubisoft and everything that's going on there. But I think this is a pretty big deal. I think this game is as big of a deal financially to Ubisoft as this delay makes it appear. I think many games you can look at a 2-3 month delay as, okay, they probably need a little more polish, make sure it's a little cleaner, not a big deal. I think this is those things, but it is a delay because they need this game to be a massive success. They've had multiple games in the past few years that have been a disappointment, not only critically, but commercially. Obviously, Outlaws, as stated in the article, is not doing as well as they thought it was going to. I know Avatar last year, similar, did not do as good as they thought it would. I could look up more Ubisoft games, but we'll just stop there for the sake of this conversation. They are in a place, especially from a business point of view, go look at their share price and how it's declined over the past few months and years, where they need this game to be a success. And I think that this is the right decision because ultimately, if it's all within the same financial year, it doesn't make a difference whether it releases now or in February. I will say, February is getting very crowded, and I was very excited for this game in November and thought it had a nice place and filled a nice hole in the rest of this calendar year. I'm happy to wait, take your time, but I do think you didn't really change at least the circumstances surrounding the release calendar. Then again, the game might be less buggy. The game might be more put together, et cetera, et cetera. Some other things that come along with this, they canceled all pre-orders, and you get now, if you pre-order the game, you get the first expansion free, which I think is really neat. They were talking about how they're going forward or kind of changing their strategy surrounding their Assassin's Creed games in terms of expansions and microtransactions, et cetera. I think this is a really big deal for Ubisoft. I think less so for the industry, but for Ubisoft. I think if this succeeds, if this game comes out and is a critical success, is a massive commercial success, I could see Ubisoft being one of the better arbiters of giving their teams the proper amount of time to get their game finished. Star Wars Outlaws not only had bugs, but had some core issues that they're going to fix within the next few months with how stealth works and with a few other not core mechanics, because they're not overhauling the game, but some fine tuning that could have maybe been found with 6 more months of work. And I think if this game sees that success, I would really hope that Ubisoft would encourage that going forward and give their teams all the time they need to make sure that it is a ready product, as opposed to a product that is 80% done and will be finished a few months after it comes out. What happens if it fails is a whole different scary question. If this game, come February next year, is a commercial disappointment, Ubisoft is going to be in a scary place. There are conversations about them going private again, which is fine with me. I don't really care if they're a public or publicly traded company or a private company. I worry that they are going to find themselves in a peculiar place because not a few years ago, 10 years ago at this point, they kind of honed in on what Ubisoft did well and they saw a mini renaissance, but I think they honed in a little too hard and forgot that new IP and new ideas are important. And I don't really know where they could go from here because new ideas and new IP aren't really guaranteed successes. I shouldn't say are not really. They definitively are not. They are the scariest risk a company can take. And if Ubisoft is in a place where they need a surefire success, I don't really know where they go from there, because if this is a disappointment, they can't keep making Assassin's Creed games. They cost too much for what they're returning. I don't imagine this game is going to be a disappointment. I think it will be good. But in the case that it's not, they need to evolve and they need to do something new, but that's going to be very risky considering how much budget and how much resources they would have to put behind that new thing. So I think this is worth talking about because I think it's a big moment for Ubisoft. If this game is a failure, it will change what the rest of their company looks like, at least for the next 10 years. I don't think it will be a failure. I think it will be a success. I think it will review well. I think it will sell well. And I think it will be a big hit. I do think Ubisoft is going to find itself in the same position a year after Shadows, when they don't have another Assassin's Creed and maybe Far Cry 7 comes out buggy or is repetitive from what the series has done before. Not worth speculating on that, but I do think Assassin's Creed Shadows, February next year, is something worth paying attention to. That is it for the news topics. So now I was going to talk about Castlevania Circle of the Moon, a game I've been playing a lot of on my Analog Pocket, originally a Game Boy Advance game. I think the first Castlevania Game Boy Advance game, but one, I don't feel great, and I'd rather not rant for 20 minutes in a positive way. I think the game is great. But I think I will probably beat it in the next few weeks, and considering October is the spooky season, maybe Sam and I will do a review. He's never played a Castlevania. Maybe he has some questions. I know I have a lot of strong opinions, so I think I will save my thoughts and opinions for a later episode rather than getting all into it now and then just reiterating it a few weeks from now. So let's move on to game, watch, and listen. This will be quick. 4 games. Talked about at the beginning of the podcast. I started playing Balatro. It came out on mobile this past week. If you have Apple Arcade, it is free for you to download. If you do not, it is $10 on the App Store. And for the 2 to 3 hours I've played, I think it is fully worth your $10. It will be my new mobile addiction. I do wish there was a vertical version. I prefer to play phone games with one hand. I don't like having to hold both hands up. It kind of ruins the purpose of a phone game. But this game is so good, I don't really care. This game nails a lot of things. I think its biggest surprise was that the risk and reward element in poker, or that exists in traditional poker, is still here, but it's a very different kind of risk and reward. In this game, the risk and reward is thinking about what hand you can get. It's taking the, hey, I know based off the jokers and multipliers I have, I can build towards a straight or build towards a 3 of a kind with a king, and that will get me more than if I just take this two pair that I have right now. It's not, in traditional poker, it's the risk of reward of, okay, can I fake out my opponent? Can I bluff? Can I get this hand off, or can I wait for the next turn on Texas Hold'em that will potentially complete my deck? This is a slightly different variation on that, which I think is interesting. If you don't know what Balatro is, it is a poker adjacent rogue like, where you have basically, I think it's 8 times 3, be like 24 hands of poker to get through, where you need to acquire a certain amount of chips to beat the level. In order to get chips, you play poker hands. You have a certain amount of hands you can play to get said amount of chips. Where the game gets interesting is there are jokers, which give you special bonuses, buffs, multipliers, which help you get more chips. So it is a game of deciding where you want to spend your fake money to get certain kinds of jokers. What jokers do you want to choose to build on top of each other to get more chips and more chips, because every level gets harder. And that loop is very addicting. I will say a quote-unquote run takes a lot longer than I thought it was going to. And because of that, it's not as... it is bite-sized, because you can stop in the middle of a run very easily and it will save your progress. But I was surprised that it is a little bit of a longer process to get through the entire thing. That aside, I think it is incredibly addicting. If you like poker, if you like card games, I think it is worth a try. Moving on to movies. I'm sure Sam and I might talk about this when he gets back, but it won't be in theaters for very long. Hell, it might not even be in theaters when you listen to this, but I really hope it is, because I want to shout out a movie called The Substance. If you are unaware of this, this is the Demi Moore and Margaret Qualley body horror film about a alternative LA where there is essentially this product that you can get that basically you inject it into yourself. Let's say you're 55 years old. You get a younger version of yourself. It is not identical to you, but it is part of you. It is you, to quote the movie. The other version is you. And an older, maybe not down on her luck, but someone who is down on herself, celebrity, gets introduced to the substance, decides to take it, and introduces a 20-year-old version of herself. And let's say when you have two lives that are very different and one might be better than the other, there are some conflicts there. And it is a riot. The last 30 minutes is just as crazy as everyone said it is. I cackled quite often throughout the movie. I think it is a really, like many movies that give me this feeling, it is doing a high wire balance act that's incredibly hard to pull off, but I think it lands the plane because of how hard it commits. It is a movie about how Hollywood treats aging women, about how the world treats aging women. I think it is, you can take even women out of it, in that it's how people perceive other people's bodies and how much focus and time is put into how you look and are presented in front of other people. And I think it does a really good job of not only showing how how external people view that and how people on the outside are looking at other people, but how you view yourself and how you feel about yourself. And I think it's really hard to tackle self-hatred and how that kind of can snowball into something very scary. And I think this movie manages to do it without ever feeling too heavy. It's a bonkers time, and I think it is worth seeing. In terms of TV, I watched the first episode of The Penguin starring Colin Farrell. The second episode will have just come out the day before this episode comes out. I had a good time. Maybe not a great time. I'm definitely going to keep watching. I am surprised at their attempt, and I presume season commitment, to trying to get us to care about the penguin as a human being. I guess I don't remember the original... I say the original, like it came out years ago. The Batman, Matt Reeves' Batman. I don't remember the penguin being like this down-on-his-luck loser in the way that this show portrays him to be, but I would assume that's fairly accurate to the canon of this universe. I think it's an interesting choice, and I think it makes the character more interesting, and I'm excited to keep watching. There is a weird dissonance between everything that's happening with him and all the crime families, and then this like 16-year-old teenager he hires. He just seems in a completely different world than the Penguin, and I understand that is part of superhero content in general, but it threw me off a little. But excited to watch it. If you like mob stuff, if you like the Batman universe, I think it's worth giving a try. Lastly, for music, I want to shout out a song that Sam and I heard on the Minneapolis radio. We were just left our Airbnb. They had it on public radio. We heard a Spanish song by Gerardo Ortiz called Hoy Más Fuerte, and it's just a vibe. It made me very happy. I think you should go listen to it. Next week, I'll be talking about Suicide Squad Kill the Justice League, hopefully, unless for some reason this week is crazy busy and I can't review it. But that's it. I hope you enjoyed the episode. Let me know what you liked that I talked about, what you didn't like, what you'd like to see from solo episodes going forward. And that's been the show. We hope you enjoyed the episode. Shout out to Mitski Kawela for the podcast artwork, and shout out to Thomny for the music. Send any comments, questions, concerns to our email, thesupermojobrothershow@gmail.com, or our Twitter account, @supermojobros. And most importantly, subscribe, leave us a review. We'd really, really appreciate it. Enjoy the rest of your day. We love you. Be kind, jump up, and be a goddamn superstar. Boop, boop. That's not really the Yoshi noise. Mm-hmm.